Okay. Does it work?
Yep. It's not a microphone, it's just a recording.
I see.
You just have to speak up.
Okay. So, good afternoon, everybody. Thank you so much for being here, and I want to thank everybody who invited us here to speak, and the Bhutanese government and anybody else here supporting this really interesting conference. And today I'm going to speak about Yartsa Gumbu, or as it is now known as Ophiocordyceps sinensis. And I will be looking at its Tibetan roots, its importance for local income, and the impact of the global market, and a whole slew of different issues. Also look at the nice auspicious date we have today, 999 in our Western system. Anyway, so I'm not guilty for the new name of Ophiocordyceps. A whole slew of the world-leading mycologists on cordyceps, including Nigel Yule-Jones, came up with this new name. And when the leading mycologists on cordyceps team up, I guess we have not much of a choice. And they have very well argued for this name. So I still have cordyceps often in my presentation. I want to point out that the first record so far known under the name of Yartsa Gumbu is from the 15th century by the text of Tsurka Namni Dorje, Mengak Jevaringsel, Instructions on a Myriad of Medicines, and there you have the first folio of that text. So this is 550 years ago, and but there also has been it been proposed that it was known under a different name even maybe 1,000 years ago under the name of Tsadachi, and thus it would be mentioned in the Gyuchu. The first record in China is 1694, and so that's 200 years later, and there of course it's known under the Chinese name Dongzhong Xiaocao, which is a literal translation of the Tibetan name. I made these points. I was on Monday still at the International Medicinal Mushroom Conference in Nangtong, China, which there was 1,000 people at the first day. Medicinal mushrooms is really a very important growing field, and there was 15 presentations on Cordyceps sinensis, and not a single one mentioned the Tibetan roots. And it was a little bit odd that I, as a foreigner, had to point out to all these Chinese Cordyceps experts what the roots of Cordyceps are. And I pointed out, I wish there was a Tibetan doctor who would have presented on medicinal mushrooms in Sova Rigpa, which really we've been missing badly at these conferences, that somebody, and if somebody wants to work with this on me, I'd be very interested. Here, the beginning of this text, which my twin brother translated, this text was translated, I was thinking that the sexual reference was a Chinese thing, but if you read this beautiful first three lines, in this world, sexual bliss is the most marvelous of all earthly pleasures, the essence of enjoyment of all the senses. I wouldn't contradict. And that's how the text starts out. I have no idea if Tsurka Namni Dorje was a monk or not. I want to find out more about him. However, what I find very interesting is the description of Yartsa Gumbu, that winter worm, the insect, very clear, and the summer grass, and down below you see the fruiting body, not the fruiting body, sorry, the flower and the fruits of a sedge, of a cobrigia, which looks actually like Yartsa Gumbu. So the Tibetan name is a very good name, and much better than just calling it Cordyceps or Ophiocordyceps sinensis, because that only addresses the fungus and not the caterpillar part of it. So in English, I clearly prefer caterpillar fungus. I've been mapping out the distribution area, and I've seen at this conference that I need to include the north of Kokonor, that area, and I have records that it's also extending into Kashmir. But in Kashmir, the populations are so low that it has not been collected yet. And I made this map by correlating by correlating the distribution area with the precipitation, how much rain per year, which indicates how good the grasslands are. And the larvae is depending on the grasslands, so that worked out pretty fine. And actually now there's Chinese mycologists and microbiologists out there visiting all of these counties, trying to map it out and get the DNA and whatnot to look in that phenomena. I correlated it to the potential tree line, and they work pretty fine. So wherever the tree line is, cordyceps is about 500, in the average, 500 meters below in the altitude and 500 meters above the tree line. And the tree line in up in Gansu, for example, the tree line is at 3,400 meters or something like that, and there it starts out in 3,000 meters, and in around Lhasa, the tree line is 4,850 meters, the highest in the world, Juniper, Shukpa forests, and there it only goes to 5,000 meters, so it doesn't go much above the tree line there. And as you all know, out here in Bhutan, I get to that later. Okay, so I've been fascinated by the growth of it in the field, and all these images are my own pictures. And here you see the different stages, the nabu, the very immature one, where the caterpillar here, the enlargement, makes the caterpillar much bigger, and the beginning of the growth of the fruiting body, of the stroma, is still very initial. You have maybe half a centimeter above ground, so very difficult to spot. But since the price is depending on the larvae, on the bu, this is not a problem to fetch good prices. In the middle you have babu, which means it's the mature stage, which is mostly collected. On the left, there's no spores developed yet. You see how the fruiting body is very straight. It's not club-shaped. So when it's very straight, it means there's no spore production yet. On the right side in the center, you see how the spore tissue is fully developed and the spores are produced. And for sustainability, this is a key issue. If everything gets collected in the stage of the first and the second specimens, we have no spore production. Spores are being the seeds of the fungus. So it's really crucial that these spores are being kept in the environment, because then sustainability is guaranteed. On the very right side, you have tsabu, overmature caterpillar fungus. And not only are the spores very well, or the ASCII, the spore cells where they are developed, formed, but the bu, the caterpillar, is completely soft. It's hollow. All the energy of the caterpillar, all the energy of the fungus has shifted out of the caterpillar, which is only fungus. At this point, besides the outside, the exoskeleton has all shifted in the fruiting body, and the value is very low. So we really got to focus in conservation, in sustainability, that we keep some of these caterpillar fungus in the ground so that we have spore distribution. Being here in Bhutan, I've been asked by people, how come that our Yartsagumbu is much lower in value than the plateau Yartsagumbu? One thing, in Tibet it's known as Gomarpu, as redhead, or in Chinese Hongtou or Hongchongcao, indicating the red, and the red is the redness of the eyes of the worm, which tells us it's based on the insect, on the host insect, the eye color, unless the fungus changes the colors of the eyes, which is an option, but I have no idea. But very important is the size, that the Himalayan caterpillar fungus is in general smaller than much of the plateau caterpillar fungus. And since it's also an aphrodisiac, I like to joke, size matters, you know. The bigger the boo, the more precious. So I put you some specimen numbers per kilogram. I got the 4,000 to 5,000 dried specimen out of an article from, I think, the Bhutan Observer or somewhere. I haven't tested that myself. If somebody knows better, please speak up. This is much smaller than the big or the middle qualities up on the plateau. We have no scientific evidence that the Himalayan Yartsagumbu would be medicinally less strong than the Tibetan one. But we also don't have any, we have very, very few research reports on the medicinal propensities of different parts of the caterpillar fungus, comparison and so on. There's, I think, so far only two papers published that looking into, is there more, is the caterpillar, the mycelium in the caterpillar fungus stronger, or is it the fruiting body? And to make this distinction, you would need to look at all the different fruiting stages, early, middle, late stages, and different regions. So we just don't have all this knowledge. I wanted to compare your production here in Bhutan with the global production, which of course is plateau production, Tibetan plateau production, including the Himalayas now. Out of the Bhutan Observer here again, we had this year we had about 600 kilograms, and last year it was nearly 700 kilograms. India in Uttarakhand had about close to 2 tons. Nepal estimated maybe 700 kilograms, but the plateau production is about 100 to 200 tons. So the Himalayan production of Yartsa Gumbu is only maybe 2 to 5% of what has been collected on the Tibetan plateau. And that's not that these areas here are less productive. It is just that that area where it can grow, the habitat in the Himalayas, is so much smaller than these vast grasslands on the Tibetan plateau. I want to do that only very short, but for some of you who might have not had any introduction to that, the life cycle, the caterpillar fungus manifests on the larvae of a moth, of a ghost moth, and I'm cheating here. The image on the right side of the insect is the close relative Hypialus humili in Europe, which used to be used as a name for the ghost moth in High Asia, but it has been not since 1969. Or 68, and of course the Chinese had different problems during the Cultural Revolution than keeping up with the taxonomy of insects. But it's time for them to catch up at this point. So it takes the larvae is about 3 years old or 4 years old before the fungus will manifest. And if the fungus is not manifesting, it would go in a pupa stage, and then the moth would develop, and the moth lives only for a few days, 3 days, 7 days. Moths don't eat. They just reproduce. And then they die, lay their eggs, and so the circle is closed. So that's the next thing, sustainability of caterpillar fungus. We need to know so much about this larvae and the life cycle and the conditions. It's really difficult. Nothing can be found out quick because, you know, this is a 4 or 5 year cycle here. Here I want to point out, going to the trade of it, that already I found these records in some Chinese books that already in 1860, 1850, 10 tons were exported from Kham down to China. This is 30 million specimen. That's not just a few people collecting. 30 million, if these figures are right, and I have no way to, you know, I just found it in a book on the history of Kham. Incredible amounts, and this area now maybe produces anywhere from probably, you know, maybe 50 tons or so. And then from 1939, from Xikang province, which existed at this time, there was already a record of 15 tons. So we really have a long history of commercial collection of Yartsa Gumbu. You know, it was sent down to China, traded for tea, brocade, and all these things the Tibetans wanted to have down from China. Here I mapped the price development in Lhasa and Litang, and I'm sure if somebody put more energy, you know, is out there every week asking on the market, could have more precise figures than I have. Whenever I am, each year, every second year, I ask what are this year's prices, what were last year's prices. Quality groups is very difficult. I didn't start out with how many specimen per pound, which would make it more absolute. But very interesting was the fact that the price increased incredibly till last year, till the stock market crashed in Shanghai before the Olympics. There was this ba-ba-ba last year, you know, and there was some China built up for these Olympics and what comes after, and the stock market also anticipated it. So the stock market collapsed and the prices went down. Then came the global financial crisis. The prices were down 40%, and they looked bad also this early this season in May. They were just as depressed as last year. However, then the monsoon was very bad this year, at least the early monsoon. So it was a drought year in Tibet, and there was caterpillar fungus production was really low, so the prices went up. So the price got corrected nearly to the heights in early 2008. So I collected all these numbers in cooperation with the China Tibet Research Institute in Beijing in 2005, and so I calculated. Officially, there's 15 tons collected in TAR in 2004, and often it's 40 to 50 tons a year officially. So this relates to back then 1.8 billion yuan, which would have been 8.5% of the GDP, of the gross domestic product, which is more than mining, would have been 40% of agriculture, and which we don't really find in the Chinese books. So the China Statistical Yearbook of Tibet, maybe it's partially included in off-farming production. But such an important thing, not included clearly in the books, nobody could tell me. Local income has been mentioned today by Ma Qianzhong, right? How important it is in Yunnan, and Peixingji alluded to that. Many areas, 70 to 90% of rural income. Overall, if you just also include the cash income, not subsistence, 40% I calculate average for TAR. And I'm sure you can extend that also out into Sichuan, at least South Qinghai and Northwest Yunnan Tibetan areas. So no other economy on this globe is so depending on mushrooms. And I'm not including here Matsutake, Sanjie Shamu, or Gugu Shamu morels, which are also really important. But this research I'm not presenting here. So here, a rough idea, annual production figures from 1999, 2004. Then I have 2007 again. You can see, if you take the blue line, that's the total, it's about minimum 35 tons a year to 50 tons a year. And my point here also being that 2007 with 40 tons, that's the most recent figure I have, is still above 2000-2001 figures. So this doesn't indicate a collapse in the harvest. I have only 5 minutes left, so I won't talk much about the medical stuff here. Also, this would be the right conference, but I'm not the right expert either. So I move on. The Chinese, traditional Chinese medicine is pretty similar than what I listed for Tibetan medicine. Western medicine, of course, very important, anti-tumor, anti-cancer, immunomodulating. Cholesterol, and this has been all these things, there's double-blind studies of these things, libido, stamina. Oh, here I wanted to point out just very quickly, adenosine is nearly identical to cordycepine, which is one of the main ingredients, only one oxygen different. So this makes a big deal in reproduction of DNA, so that could be one of the reasons why it's anti-cancer, anti-tumor, and also energy. ATP, which delivers energy in the cells, is based on adenosine. Nobody argues over the genus Cordyceps as being of medical importance because cyclosporin, a very famous drug, is derived from Cordyceps subsessilis. Taking you a little bit into the fields here, going close here, motorcycles, everywhere motorcycles now, you can just tell by the motorcycles, the collectors are out there. This is one of the main objectives collecting caterpillar fungus is to get your motorcycle as a Tibetan male. Families out there collecting, there was just this May, late May, here in Biru, which, battery quickly, I hit that here. Okay, take some moment. We'll be back. Biru is the area of Cordyceps collection up there in South Nakchu, because they have the biggest boo there, and the government is really involved in the collection there. They have all these new tents, heated and double wall tents, and it looks to me like there's village councils or county, somebody organizes this whole thing. Telephone tower in the back, and on the right side, the Rakti paved highway. There's no paved highway in the surrounding 200 kilometers, but Rakti comes from this county, so he built a nice highway for his compatriots. Yunnan collection camps. I was surprised in Yunnan that it was a place where there was no licensing system. All over TAR, Qinghai, also many areas, Sichuan, you have to have a license as a collector. If you live there, it's cheap. If you come from the outside, it's very expensive. But outside collectors are being kept out more and more, especially the Huis. The Muslim collectors in Qinghai cannot come back. One permit was 5,000 yuan the last year, 2 years ago in Qinghai. So that's about $800. We're talking about double the annual average income there. Harvesting pressures, of course, everybody's out there. Dengchen, for example, 60% of the population collects. I have a suspicion that maybe the figures, the collection figures, could be balanced, that there's new areas discovered, because people say, hey, what about up there? We never looked up there. Let's look up there. So there's always new collection areas added, which might balance otherwise a decrease in population. There's a Chinese guy, Yang Darong, who claims there's only 5 to 7% left, and I was wondering if Ma Zhejiang was referring to Ya Darong's figures, who postulates that we used to have 10 times, 20 times the amount of caterpillar fungus 20 years ago. But I shared that with a lot of Chinese colleagues, and everybody says, nah, don't worry. So these numbers are not based on real field data, and yes, we have to worry, but I asked so many collectors about the situation, do we have less? And everybody says, well, I find less, but there are so many more people. The dealer said, well, we still have plenty there. Mm-hmm. And so my feeling is we might have less, but we do not have a crash of the population. And part of it is the caterpillar is dead, and the fungus will die in a few weeks, 1 week, 2 weeks, as long as we get enough spores in the environment, sustainability should be guaranteed. And people calculating how much topsoil we lose through digging of it, you know, in comparison with any other economic activity, bringing cash into a rural economy, it is quite small. So I'm somewhat on the side. I'm not completely alarmed, but we need real research, and Bhutan is leading here with doing long-term field trials. Nothing like that in China yet. I mean, such an important thing. They do in DNA and molecular studies. Nobody does sustainability studies, which, yeah, you got to be 5 years, 10 years out there, do this research. But that's what we need. And my simple suggestion is stop the season a week early, maybe 10 days early, so that the last fruiting of the boo is still in the ground and can spread its spores. And the people already made a lot of money. To stop the people early in the season, before they made their money, is difficult. But in the end, say, come on, guys, time to go home. Want to have something next year. Mm-hmm. Could be very simple. And if people want to start doing something, I think this is the simplest solution. And the licensing system all over the Tibetan Plateau is a very powerful vehicle for all of this. Here there was the first law in TAR was crafted in 2006, which was after I did a cooperation, as I mentioned before, with Lorong Chandui, which is basically research. It wasn't about many things weren't addressed yet, but it's a beginning. People are really working. There is some momentum there now in China too. And just to summarize very quickly, so the roots are really in Tibet. China got hooked on it, and China drives the market. Japan, Korea, a little bit in the West, who wants to eat worms? We just don't do that. But they are really tasty, good stuff. But it took me a long time to convince myself to eat it. Very tasty, but in the West we have the artificial production, which from China I got the figures, only about 10% of the cordyceps market, maybe 20%, is artificially cultivated cordyceps, which is much cheaper. Well, I said cash dependency. You have that in Bhutan, up also in the high mountain areas by now, I guess. Unique global situation of fungal economy. We got to know more and the long-term studies. Okay, so somewhat in time, a little over. Eh? So I want to thank you all, especially Sienna and Denise, who really strong-armed to come me out here. And thank you so much for doing that. And I always wanted to see Bhutan. And if you want to have some PDF research papers on what I have presented here, send me an email and I'll send you the PDF. I can't put it up on my webpage, outdated technology. And now there's the time for the commercial break. You might be wondering, how can I do this research? Partially because I'm not integrated in a research institute. I might get institutionalized soon, but I'm not so far. And one way how I can do my research is I organize mushroom tourism to Tibet. So I take interested, like, Chinese medicine practitioners, mushroom growers from the U.S. or Switzerland or Germany, and then we do what's everything exciting in Tibet, plus lots of mushrooms. And so if you're interested in that, I have my little advertisement card. So thank you so much.
I'm really interested in your presentation because Yatsugambo comes from where I was born.
Gansu?
No, I'm not Gansu. Ah. I'm in Chamdo.
Chamdo, okay.
Yeah. I think you say the positive side of Yatsugambo.
Yeah.
But I see so much negative side, which is so many people killing due to the Yatsugambo.
Yeah.
Fighting every year. Maybe 100 people are killed.
Wow.
Maybe more due to land ownership.
Land dispute,
Fighting, thief. But the distribution of the amount of money, the local people are good. One Yatsugambo, you may get 10 yuan to 20 yuan.
Yeah.
The salesmen, they make 50 yuan.
50
yuan, Yatsugambo at the moment.
So, several issues here.
Just let me finish.
Okay.
And also, in the environment, I saw many places where they said Yatsugambo is damaged. The whole land where we're getting so much getting warmer, which is due to Yatsugambo digging.
I didn't mention climate change at all. I had it on there, on the slides, right?
Yeah.
So big issue.
Because the trained people, they may have small digging tools.
Yeah.
Maybe just dig up just Yatsugambo.
Yeah.
When you chase a driving force by money, and they dig a large area of the topsoil, which the topsoil hold the dampness of the water, so it's all run away.
Yeah.
So many people, they believe the changement of in the weather in Tibet, and one of the problem is due to digging too much Yatsugambo.
Yeah.
Okay. So I wonder whether you can say something.
So first, people...
Or maybe you're going to do research, so
no.
Why not you do research? How many people killed every year?
Well, I collect each time I ask around problematic situations, and I showed you the one picture from Nianchen Tangla, and the day I came there was the day after two people got killed. These two people, it was at the Drolma Tso, at a sacred lake, and the dispute was, this is sacred land here, you cannot dig here. The other said, yes, we dig here. I don't know who got killed in the end, but that human blood flowing into the sacred lake was probably not in the idea of any sacredness. So it is an issue. 100 people seems to me a very high estimate. I have to scratch for these numbers, and in the law they always talk about avoiding these conflicts, and sometimes it's county borders disputes, grazing right disputes, then which carry over. So it's a big issue. Take it in correlation how much money is being made there, and then how many people die from it. It is very sad, but for the whole size of the industry, there's over a million Tibetans out on the slopes collecting each year. So every person that dies is a person too much, but it's not like the whole thing is completely out of hand. The second point was, I forgot to mention in my talk, climate change. Yes, climate change is a big deal, and in a research proposal I've written for Deutsche DFG, German Research Council, I have mentioned this point. It's a very important point. We have a change of altitudinal limits, and that's very interesting and could be quite a problem for Cordyceps sinensis. However, Cordyceps sinensis in the past had a huge enlargement of its territory because of deforestation in Tibet. Tibetans don't eat wood, they live off their livestock. So they turned huge amounts of forest area into grazing grounds, which is the perfect environment for Yartsagumbu. So I'm convinced that human impact doubled probably, or something like that, or maybe at least added triple of the habitat for caterpillar fungus. There is some caterpillar fungus under trees. I've seen it in Chukpa forests under junipers, open forests. You need your herbal layer so that the caterpillar fungus can feed. But in general, it's grasslands and shrublands. The environmental impact with digging up, I have not seen any evidence that anybody removed big patches. Everybody usually tries to dig just for the caterpillar fungus, and you gotta give yourself about 10 centimeters so you don't hurt the boo. So you have to dig around and, you know, try to try to find out in which direction the caterpillar fungus turns. And local people, I think, would have and have been instructed in many counties in TAR to close the holes again. That's one. I think one of the main arguments for keeping outsiders out is that local people identify with their resources and will protect it much better.
In the interest of having a tea break for those who want it, maybe we can do that.
Well, let's give one other person a chance.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, we just have 10 minutes before the whole next session starts. So, but
there's another. Yeah.
There's another one coming.
In. Okay. So. Oh, there's a sample if anybody wants to see it. Mine got trampled at the last presentation. Jen, yeah? Yeah. Oh, ask Nigel. He's the mycologist. Is that Nigel? Are you Nigel? No, sorry. I was hoping it was described like you. Yeah, come up.
I'm curious, you fungi are affected by overharvesting. The spores are very seldom the limiting factor in fungi. It's usually the habitat loss or the exposure loss.
Yeah.
And my question is anybody doing any basic biology on the moss?
There's a little bit, I mean, I tried to contact all these experts and everybody said, we cannot tell you what kind of moss you have here by looking at the larvae. So I think it's especially Chinese entomologists looking at the larvae, and they now say they have about 60 to 70 species identified as hosts for caterpillar fungus. And well, so far there's 39 species of Titarodes described for the Tibetan plateau. Ghost moth. So we don't know enough. It's a real problem. mushroom collection in general, matsutake, chanterelles, king bullets, is absolutely sustainable. It's like picking apples. We have 2 30-year studies which tell us production doesn't go down unless people start hurting the mycelium, like raking for matsutake, which is a real malpractice and which needs to be eliminated. But that's a big problem. But And that was part of my, I think part of why I'm somewhat optimistic with the resilience of Yartzagumbu is we're dealing with a fungus which just works very different than most medicinal plants. And I had a guy in Wangshuo in Dichen explaining to me, I said, you had all these forests, lots of it is gone. You had all this wildlife, it's gone. You're not worried about caterpillar fungus? He says, no, it's very different. Each year, we get it again. This year, bad year, but it was dry. Next year, good year, we'll have it back. So I don't take that perspective, but it is, he's not wrong. I mean, we know so little about fungi, it's really pathetic.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.